The following audio is from Fathom Church in downtown Littleton, Colorado. More information about Fathom can be found at fathomchurch.org.
Let's grab our Bibles, please. Everybody grab a Bible. There are Bibles under every single chair. If you don't have a Bible in a translation that makes sense, you may have that. That is our gift to you. But we need everybody to have a hand on a text. You can have a phone or a tablet. We're in John chapter 7, the Gospel according to John chapter 7. This is what we do every Sunday at Fathom is we study God's Word. We start with God's Word and we let it inform us. That's how we go deeper. That's part of this church's vision. So as you're turning there, John chapter 7, as you turn there, I'm not really much of a bucket list kind of guy. I don't know, maybe y'all have bucket lists. I don't really have a list of things that I feel like I want to do before I die as some sort of fulfillment, or like my life will not be complete if I don't follow through with all my bucket lists. I don't really have that. Like if there's something that comes up and I want to do it, I'm just going to do it. But I do have one thing that I feel like would top the bucket list of my life, and if it happened to me, I would drop everything and just hit it, okay? This is my one thing. If Bear Grylls asked me to go camping, I'm in. Like, you know what? If he shows up today, like he ziplines in here, you know, gets all crazy in here, hands me a knife and says, Chris, let's go. I, you know what I would do? I'd say, Luke, let's play some more music. And I would leave. I would just leave y'all high and dry, and I'd go out into the wilderness on an adventure with Bear Grylls. If you don't know who Bear Grylls is, okay, Bear Grylls is a British adventurer, and he's made famous by this show, Man vs. Wild, and then he's done about 17 or 18 different spinoffs from that that aren't nearly as good. But seriously, church, if Bear showed up right now, I would be out of here. And here's why I want to go on an adventure with him. Because I know he'd keep me alive. See, when I go out into the wilderness on my own, I'm prone to do stupid things that lead to injuries that I need to go to urgent care for. And so, like, I just know that Bear could keep me alive. Like, he this is exactly what he'd be like. And forgive my terrible British accent, but I'm going to try it, right? He'd say, all right, Chris, come eat these berries. These berries, because they're full of vitamins and energy. Because we're going to need it as we run down this hill. You got to jump right off that 40-foot cliff. Avoid those razor-sharp rocks and into that crystal cool, clear lake. Even though there's a nice footpath right down there, we're going to do that, okay? I'd be like, all right. Like, that's what Bear would do. He'd make it exciting, full of adventure, but I just trust that Bear would keep me safe. There's only one part that would be really rough for me if I went camping with Bear Grylls, and that's because if you've watched the show, Bear eats some really bizarre things. All for adventure, but I am not plucking out a raw caribou eye and eating it. I'm not eating like a live scorpion, okay? Pinching my tongue. No, I'm going to pass on that. I'll eat the berries with the vitamins, all right? But I'm going to pass on all the other stuff. And then the other thing that I might just opt out of is, have you ever been on like the desert things that he does? Like when he's in a desert, like hot, dry, just walking through the sand, getting sunburned, can't find water anywhere. Like, have you seen what he drinks? Yeah, I think I'd pass on that one. I think I would pass. I'm not sure about that. But here, it got me thinking this week about our text, thinking about Bear Grylls. Because have you ever been so thirsty? Like, Bear is in the middle of nowhere, and he's willing to drink things that you would just say, nah, I'll just die, right? Like, but have you ever been so thirsty that you felt like you might just keel over and that's it? You know what? I can't go any further. Like, you literally wouldn't survive if you didn't get a drink of water. Well, today in our text, church, Jesus is going to talk about water. He's going to talk about thirst. And it will have massive implications, not only for the original readers of this text, but for us today. So we have a lot to get through. We're going to get through the whole chapter. Chapter 7, so we'll be out of here in about 3 hours, but I promise it won't take that long. We're going to start slow, and then we're going to haul some serious speed. Ooh, that could have been bad. It didn't, though. John chapter 7. Hey, let's open to verse 1, okay? John 7, verse 1. Follow me along in here. Ooh, we would have had to cut the podcast on that one. John 7. After this, Jesus went about in Galilee. He would not go about in Judea because the Jews were seeking to kill him. And now the Jews' feast of booths was at hand. Okay, so we're going to stop there. Those first two verses, they set up the whole rest of this chapter and actually next chapter. So when John says after this, he starts with after this. Whenever you see a transition like that, you got to say, what was this that we are now after? So after this is talking about last chapter. And last chapter in chapter 6, we know that there's about 6 months that transpire in between the end of chapter 6 and the beginning of chapter 7. And the reason why we know that is because in chapter 6, we saw Jesus feed the 5,000, and that was during the Passover festival. And so now we just find out in verse 2 that this is now the Feast of Booths, or the Feast of Tabernacles, your translation might say, which is about 6 months later in the Jewish calendar. And so at this point, we're 6 months after last chapter, and Jesus, it says, is hanging around in Galilee because he wanted to avoid Judea. So in Israel at this time, we've talked about this, there are three primary regions, but we'll talk about two of them. Galilee is in the north, Judea is in the south, and then Samaria is in the center. And so those are kind of our three main areas that we're going to be thinking through. And so the Jews, it says the Jews, which is the probably the Jewish elite, the Jewish teachers, they tend to reside in Judea. In Judea, where Jerusalem is. That's kind of where the Jewish authorities are going to be. And Jesus has been hanging up in Galilee, away from them, a whole different jurisdiction where he cannot be, well, he can't get into as much trouble as he could if he went down to Judea. And then it says that the Feast of Booths was at hand. Now, the Feast of Booths or the Feast of Tabernacles is kind of a lesser talked about feast in our churches, but it is of huge importance for these upcoming verses. So here's what I learned this week. According to Josephus, who is a first century Roman Jewish scholar and historian, the Feast of Booths is actually the most popular of the three principal Jewish feasts. It's the most popular, maybe even more than Passover, probably because you didn't have to make big animal sacrifices. Right? If you don't have to bring your best goat to kill that thing, like you're just going to go and party for a week in Jerusalem rather than bring a sacrifice, it's going to draw more of a crowd. And so they think that maybe tens, if not 100,000 people would show up in Jerusalem for this festival. It's a full week festival. And what they would do is they would be celebrating the period of time after Moses led them out of Egypt in the Exodus, but before they reached the promised land. So that between those two times, the Israelites spent 40 years in the desert wandering. And that's what this Feast of Booths would be celebrating. So you will probably remember that story of Moses being, you know, leading them out of Egypt, right? You remember that? You've seen the movies at some point? Yes? Yes, okay. You know that? They get to the Red Sea. Well, right after that, they start wandering in the desert for 40 years because they just are grumbling against the Lord. And during this time in the wilderness, God provides for the Israelites. And that's actually what the people are celebrating in this Feast of Booths. So while in the desert, here's a couple of ways God provided for his people. He shows up as a cloud, like a cloud of smoke, and leads them during the day. And then that cloud turns into a pillar of fire at night to give them light and warmth and protection. And so they would celebrate this feast with lots of lighting of candles and rites that would, like all of Jerusalem would be lit up at this point. So light and God are kind of equated. And we're going to see that next chapter, that metaphor. But for our purposes today, one of the most important things that God provides to the Israelites in the desert is water. So in Exodus 17, so they have just gotten out of the promised land. They have just, you know, the walls of water have collapsed over Pharaoh and his armies. They just get out, they sing a couple of songs, and then the people get a little ticked. Because now they're out in the desert, and there's no water. And in Exodus 17, Moses goes before God and is a little bit irritated because he just saved all these people from slavery, right? But he's a little irritated because they're grumbling about water and not having any. And so God instructs Moses to take his staff, the same staff that he hit the Red Sea with that parted, right? He says, take your staff, strike this rock, and out of it will flow water. And so that's how God provided water to his people in the desert for the next 40 years, is out of a rock, like in the middle of the desert, like Bear Grylls doesn't need to do anything gross, right? That's kind of what happens in that. And that's why we celebrate the Feast of Booths. Like, that's what they're celebrating. Now, this is what would happen. The Jews who live in the rural areas would come to Jerusalem, and they would build these makeshift structures, like kind of like a tent, kind of like a booth, hence the word booth, right? Like a little tabernacle. And they would live in that little booth for the week-long festival. And then even the locals would get out of their houses and either in their courtyards or maybe up on their flat roofs, they'd build a little tent. And it was all to say, hey, we're experiencing what our forefathers experienced, camping, like urban camping. Like we've been camping for 40 years out in the desert. We're doing that for 7 days of this festival. So all of that stands in the background as John tells us that the Feast of Booths is at hand. Okay, let's look at now at verse 3. So Jesus' brothers said to him, "Leave here and go to Judea, that your disciples also may see the works you are doing. For no one works in secret if he seeks to be known openly. If you do these things, show yourself to the world." For not even his brothers believed in him. All right, let's stop for a second. Brothers here, the brothers that are being talked about, are literally Jesus' brothers, his younger brothers. Mary and Joseph had children after Jesus, and so these are his brothers. And back in John chapter 6, so what we saw last week, we read that Jesus, he preaches a sermon, he so ticks off the crowds that are following him that 20,000 plus abandon him. They walk away from him, and 12 guys are left. Only 12 are left. And so now Jesus has been hanging out in Galilee for about 6 months. And I hear this in my head. His brothers are just, they're coming to him and they're saying, "Listen, bro, when are you going to get back on the horse? Like, it's been 6 months. It's time to get out of mom's basement. Like, let's move back into what you were doing. Go to Judea. Judea, the festival is here. You're going to have huge crowds. And listen, yeah, I know you messed up that last sermon, screwed yourself out of 20,000 people. I get it. But hear me. There's a big crowd coming to Jerusalem. You could probably get them back. Just do something sweet. Show him a sign." And his brothers are egging him to say, "It's time to do this again. Jesus, it's time to get back into your ministry." You see, the Feast of Booths at this point is such a famous attraction that literally if Jesus were to go there and like make bread into wine, he's done that already, or take a small loaf of bread and like feed the multitudes. Like if he does that, he's going to reclaim a ton of people as his followers. And his brothers know that. They're like, "Jesus, let's go. Let's go to Judea." But I think it's really interesting that verse 5, John adds verse 5 as kind of a commentary. Not even his brothers believed in him. What does that mean? Like, what? Why would John give us that little blurb? I think it's to show us that John's or Jesus' brothers, they did not really believe in him yet, and thus they didn't really know what they were asking him to do. So we do know from the later parts of the New Testament that Jesus' brothers do in fact believe in him after the resurrection, right? And like I've said this before, church, like the fact that Jesus convinces his brothers and his mother to worship him as Lord is an apologetic for the truthfulness of the gospel. Like, hear me, I love my brother. Love him. He's a good guy. He's very talented. He's a CPA. He's brilliant. He's got a great put-together life. But I'll tell you what, it would take a whole heck of a lot for him to convince me that he is the only begotten Son of God. Like, bro would have to rise from the dead, okay? Like, literally come back to life for me to say, "Okay, I'll bow before you, Matthew." Like, no, it's not going to happen. I'm just telling you. Like, really, only if he rose from the dead. And so his brothers, they don't believe in him at this point. They don't believe that he is the Son of God. And so they say, "Come on, you know, take the show to Jerusalem. Bring it to the," it's like trying to be an actor and living in Pueblo. He's like, "Come on, move to LA, you know, get this thing on the road." And what does Jesus say? Well, this is really interesting. Look at verse 6. Jesus said to them, to his brothers, "My time is not yet come, but your time is always here. The world cannot hate you, but it hates me because I testify about it, that its works are evil. You go up to the feast. I am not going up to this feast. For my time is not yet fully come." After saying this, he remained in Galilee. Okay, so this whole "my time is not yet come," this kind of becomes a refrain. We've already heard it a couple of times in John's gospel. It shows up all the time. And his time of being known, what he's talking here is his time of being known for who he really is. Like his time of fully revealing who he was and the work he has to do has not yet come. Because his unbelieving brothers, they want him to go to Jerusalem to perform signs and to impress people and to gather a big crowd. But the signs for which Jesus had to come to do in Jerusalem, like the signs he was going to do there, is the sign of his death on the cross. And so that sign, he's not yet ready to do. But they don't get that. They don't know exactly what they're asking him. But the piece on these couple of verses I want us to focus in on, because it'll help us for the rest of this, is verse 7. He says, the world doesn't hate you. It hates me. And then he tells us why the world hates him. He says that the world hates me because I testify to the world that its works are evil. So essentially, this is what Jesus is saying. The world hates me. And if I go to Jerusalem, they're going to hate me. And church, for us today, listen, if Jesus were to come to Littleton, we would likely hate him. Like if we were to hear him on the news, the general response of the people of the world is not acceptance and love and hey, we need to hear more of this guy. We need to see more of what this guy has to do. But when Jesus comes onto the main stage, the opinion of Jesus of how the crowd will respond to him is, I hate this guy. Jesus doesn't seem to have a very high view of what the populace is going to think of him when he shows up in Jerusalem. And that's going to come back, so hold on to that thought, okay? What happens next? Well, in verse 10, it tells us that his brothers go up to Jerusalem to the Feast of Booths. And then later on, it says that Jesus went up to Jerusalem, leaving Galilee for the last time in John's gospel. He's headed up to or down to Judea, to Jerusalem. And this is the last time he's going to go before he goes to the cross. And then even so, like even though he does go to Jerusalem, after he told his brothers he wasn't going to, he does it totally differently than they would expect. He goes in pure secrecy, maximum discretion. I mean, flying under the radar. His brothers wanted him to go crazy. And he just kind of sneaks in the back door. And look then what Jesus finds when he gets to verse 11. The Jews were looking for him at the feast and saying, where is he? And there was much muttering about him among the people. While some said he is a good man, others said, no, he is leading the people astray. Yet for the fear of the Jews, no one spoke openly of him. He thinks they're going to hate him. And then he shows up. And what Jesus hears is that the crowd is already divided on him. The crowd is already kind of in a couple of camps. First, it says that the Jews are looking for him, saying, where is he? And when it says the Jews, it's not talking about all Jewish people. It's talking about the Jewish elite, the Jewish leadership, the Pharisees, the teachers of the law, the scribes. That's normally what is meant by the Jews here. And so likely, this is what we're meant to infer, I think, is that they're expecting that the Feast of Booths is going to be the thing that draws Jesus out of hiding. Bro's been in hiding in Galilee for 6 months. We haven't seen him. And so maybe the Feast of Booths is going to be the time where he's drawn out, and we'll get a chance to arrest him. That's the Jews, okay? But then we hear about the crowds or the people, and this is the masses. This is the rest of the Hebrew people that are there. They're from Galilee, some are from Judea, some are from all over the place, and they're in the city, and they're already torn. They're already torn about this guy, right? Some say he's a good man, which means a whole lot of nothing, right? You ever said that about somebody? Oh, he's a good guy. What do you mean? Like, what do you mean by good man? Like, so note that they have no inkling about what we talked about last week, that he might be a prophet or that it might be the Messiah, the Christ. They're just like, no, I heard some good stuff about him, but I haven't seen him in 6 months. He seems like a good guy, though. Like, that's kind of what's going on. And then the other half of the people are like, no. I hear that he stirs the people up. Like, he's a bad guy. Like, you don't want to get tangled up in the Jesus stuff. They're trying to kill him for a reason, right? And so the crowd is already kind of divided in their opinions about Jesus. And church, this was true then, and it is still true today. Jesus always divides the room. Jesus will always divide the room. Like, no matter what room you're in, whether you're on an airplane or you're in a church, you start talking about Jesus and you're going to find people divided on him. And this division is going to carry us through the rest of this passage. So here's what I want us to do. I want us to speed up a little bit. We're going to speed up in this text, and we're going to look at the next paragraphs and summarize what Jesus is saying about himself. And what he says will only go to divide the crowd even more. So let's look at verse 16. So Jesus answered them. This is the crowd at this point. He says, "My teaching is not mine, but him who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking on my own authority. The one who speaks of his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true, and in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me?" Okay. So Jesus kind of disrobes the shroud of secrecy, gets up in the temple and starts talking, and he's addressing what people are talking about. People are trying to figure out where he learned all of this stuff. Like, where did Jesus get this teaching? What seminary did he go to? You know, where did this come from? With what authority is Jesus teaching? And Jesus says, "My teaching is not mine, but his who sent me." Okay, so the gist of what Jesus is going to say in the next two paragraphs are all contained in these few verses. As Jesus addresses the criticisms and questions about who he is, the question that keeps coming up is, where is Jesus from? It manifests itself in two ways. The first question is, where did his teaching come from? But then ultimately, they're going to get to the point where they say, where did this guy come from? Like, what town is he from? And Jesus essentially responds with the same question over and over and over. And so maybe in your discipleship groups, you felt this as you were reading this and studying this week. But he says, "Listen, I come from God. I am the one sent by God. I have authority because it's from God." Like, this is the theme that we've seen in the Gospel of John. Jesus is claiming to come from God. And then he goes on to say, and here's where they get divided, okay? He goes on to say, if you knew who God was, like if you trusted in who God was, if you were really seeking to do the will of this God that you say you follow, then you would know that it was me who he sent. But instead, you're trying to kill me. And that's what he says will divide the room. Like, he says that, and obviously he's going to split people. He's saying, "I am from God. I come with ultimate authority. And if you knew that, you would know that he sent me." Like, that'll divide the room today. Saying that you have ultimate authority over people's lives will divide the room. So my first job, like my first job that I ever had, I've told you about this at other points, was it the wonderful establishment of McDonald's, okay? I was 14 years old, and I found out that there are only two places in my town that would hire a 14-year-old. One of them was McDonald's, the other one was Taco Bell, okay? And so at McDonald's, they won me over with their great employment package. No, right? They won me over because it was close enough so I could rollerblade myself to get there. So let me tell you this, there is nothing cooler than a 14-year-old, greasy, pimply eighth grader on rollerblades in a McDonald's uniform with a bowl cut, right? There's just nothing cooler than that. I was looking real good. So hear me. The McDonald's only hired one 14-year-old, that was me, for the entire summer, and I think they only hired me to just do whatever grunt work they didn't want to do. I think it was just a torture device, because this is what they said. They told me that you had to be 16 years old to work the grill. And I was 14. So apparently the first 2 years of high school are critical if you want to flip burgers, okay? But if you're 14, forget it. So what they would do then is they would have me clean up the dining room. They call it the dining room. Doesn't sound like a dining room. You ever been there? It's like covered in grease. It's nasty, right? And then they'd have me clean the bathrooms, which is understandable, and mop the kitchen and do the dishes. Like, those are the things that I expected to do. But when I ran out of normal tasks to do, the manager would make me do things that I just thought were cruel and unusual. Here's a couple of them. They made me climb in the play place, like those tubes, with a rag and a squirt bottle, and clean the inside of the tubes And like, hear me, if you're taking your kids to McDonald's after this, don't let them go in the play place, okay? Because those things are nasty, like boogery and gross, and I'm just crawling through those things trying to clean them. That was one of my jobs. Another one of my jobs was in the play place to go into the ball pit and fish out debris. Like that's a cesspool of nasty, okay? Like there's dried bits of food, there's chicken nuggets, there's socks, there's all this gross stuff. Once, I kid you not, I found a rolled up diaper in the ball pit. So who's taking their kids there after church? Anybody? Meet you at McDonald's, okay? The worst thing by far that I ever had to do at McDonald's, one afternoon my boss came to me and told me to go outside. This is summer, it's hot outside. I'm wearing black slacks covered in grease, right? And he says, go outside, hook up the hose, spray down, and then scrub the dumpster. So literally, I cleaned a trash dumpster, like I got a hose, and it seemed like a futile task, right? Like I am cleaning a dumpster in which we are going to throw more trash that's hidden behind a little fence in our parking lot. Like, what was the point of that? Now, hear me. Why did I have to do all these things? Because my boss at McDonald's had absolute authority over me in the realm of McDonald's. He could tell me whatever he wanted to, and I had to do what he says or quit. Those were my two options. Now hear me, if one of the other also pimply 16-year-olds who were burger flippers had said, hey, go, Chris, go ahead and scrub the dumpster, I would have flipped him something. Like I would not have done that. Why? Because he was 16 and he was flipping burgers at McDonald's, the same McDonald's that I was at. But when my boss said, Chris, go clean the dumpster, they could have told me anything. They could have said, this is how it works. Hey, here's how things have to be. There's no debating over this. This is the standard, and if you don't do this standard, there's going to be hell to pay. That's essentially what the boss can do. And Jesus stands up in the temple at this point in Jerusalem, and he tells everybody, I have absolute authority. I'm not coming to you on the authority of some other teacher. There's no little debate that's going to go on after this. You don't get to decide whether you like what I have to say or not. You don't get to mince my words and kind of come to some sort of nice conclusion. He says, here's the standard. And if you don't reach this standard, you're going to miss me. You're going to miss me. And actually, he says, if you knew the God who you love, you would know that he sent me and you'd be jumping over that bar. But you don't. And then what ensues in the following paragraphs in John chapter 7 is a debate over what town Jesus is from, like more debate about what authority he has to speak. And all the people bicker back and forth about where he's coming from. Like literally, they'll say, is he from Galilee? I'm not sure if he's from Galilee. Wait a second, we're not supposed to know where the Messiah comes from. And then somebody says, oh, I think the Messiah is supposed to come from Bethlehem. And they're like, but we know where this guy comes from. And Jesus says again and again and again, listen, you think you know where I come from, but I come from God. And he essentially just tells them over and over, you don't know me. You don't know me. And so this continues for the entire Feast of Booths. But I want us to turn ahead to verse 37 because verse 37 is kind of the crux of the Feast of Booths, and it's where I want us to really hone in on. So look at verse 37. It says this, on the last day of the feast, the great day. Now, I stop us right there because I don't want us to read the rest of this yet. We need to have context about this last great day of the Feast of Booths. So on this last great day of the feast, everyone who came to Jerusalem, now picture this with me, they would gather together at the temple. Tens of thousands of people gather in the courts of the temples, fill up the courts of the temples. And then they would read the prophet Zechariah, chapter 14, which prophesies about the coming Messiah. So I'm going to put a small portion of this on the screen, Zechariah 14. You don't need to turn there, but let me read this. You can follow along and just pretend like you're there, celebrating all that God has done in the desert. Then the Lord my God will come, and all the holy ones with him. On that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost, and there shall be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. So light, remember the imagery of the fire in the sky at night? Light. Verse 8. On that day, living waters shall flow out from Jerusalem. Half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea, and it shall continue in summer as in winter. And the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day, the Lord will be one and his name one. So they would read this in the temple with thousands, tens of thousands, seas of people. And then those people would begin to sing. And they would sing psalms. And they would sing from Isaiah. And just picture 50, 100,000 voices singing praises and exaltations to God, thanking him for his provision, and gathered in that temple in Jerusalem, all with the backdrop of Zechariah, okay? From that day, on that day, living waters will flow out of Jerusalem. They're all in Jerusalem. They've all got this going on. They're singing and praising in anticipation of the one day that God would send his Messiah. And then even more, okay, as they're singing, right in the middle of those tens of thousands of voices, the priests would carry a gigantic bowl of water, a golden bowl filled with water, in and through the crowds, up into the center of this courtyard, and there would be an altar there. And they would take this water, they called it the water rite, and they would pour the water on the altar, and water would flood over the altar, and it would flow out into the courts around people's feet, imaging this Zechariah thing, okay? And this water, they would say, this is living water that we're anticipating God is going to pour on Jerusalem and do something that we've never seen before. The Messiah will come, and all nations will be drawn to him. Now look at 37. On that day of the feast, Jesus stood up and cried out, "If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, and as the scriptures have said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water." Jesus says, "If anyone is thirsty, let him come to me and drink." In the middle of that scene, Jesus is declaring to the 100,000 people, all of that you're doing right now, it points to me. Everything that you anticipate, everything that you long for, everything that you're waiting for God to do, he's doing it. I'm here. You see, church, at the very root of Christianity, like if you don't know what Christianity is, it's not debates about where Jesus might come from. It's not an ongoing evaluation and discussion of authority that Jesus has. It's not a new set of morals that we can do so we can do the right things and not do the wrong things. It's not partnering with God to go change the world. At the very root of Christianity is thirst. It's the awareness that I'm dying of thirst and I need to go to Jesus to get a drink. See, Jesus divides the crowd at this point because they're looking for all those other things. And Jesus is saying, no, you just have to be thirsty. And you must come to me and drink. But they think they need something else. And hear me, church, so do we. Like we think we need a little Jesus to help us with our theology or our morals or our relationships. And Jesus is screaming here. He says, no! You don't need any of those things. You are in a desert. And if you don't come and get a drink from me, you're dead. But we want to have theological debates, right? About who Jesus is. And hear me, listen, I love theology. I'm all about it. We're going to go deep like that. Like, we love that stuff. But at the root of your theology, there must be a keen awareness that unless God provides water, you're dead. you're dead. So when I was a senior in high school, literally I'd been a believer for just about a year at that point. And I remember as a senior in high school, I was just so hungry for God's word. I was so hungry to try and figure this thing out because I didn't know anything. I had no clue. And so here's what I did. I started going to a Saturday night service at another church that preached just straight through books of the Bible. Like, I didn't go to that church. It really was my church home. But I started going to this church because I wanted to figure this guy out. I wanted to figure Jesus out and God out and the Bible out. And so I was hungry for it, and I went to understand as much as I could. And I remember specifically one Saturday night as I'm driving home from the service. I'm driving in my Subaru. I'm listening to some worship music in the car. And I can't remember what was taught on, which really bodes well for my career, right? Like, I'm in my Subaru and I'm singing worship songs and I've got it turned up as loud as I can handle. And I'm driving home and my mind is so full of information, of theology, I'm bursting with knowledge about God. And all of a sudden I'm driving home and all of a sudden I'm singing a worship song. All this stuff collides and I just start weeping. And hear me, that's weird for a 17-year-old guy in a Subaru to just start crying on the road in Colorado Springs. So I'm like literally to the point where I can't stop crying. I have to pull over so that I don't, you know, wreck my Subaru. And I'm just singing some lame old worship song that we would never sing at Fathom Church because it's not cool enough, right? But I was singing and I was weeping. And here's what happened, I think, in that moment, church. I had learned some stuff and I had experienced some stuff. But at that moment, I realized that I needed Jesus. Like, I realized that I had a thirst, and the only thing that was going to quench it, Jesus. And now hear me. Like, listen, I don't want you to paint me as some kind of like over-emotional, you know, just you got to feel it sort of person. Like, I'm not that. We need our brains. We need to study. I hope you hear that as we teach here at Fathom. We want to go deep in the Word. We want to study. We want to enrich our minds. At the root of all of that, there must be a thirst for Christ. Listen, some of y'all have come here and you're still trying to figure out what to do with this Jesus guy. You're just like the crowd. Maybe he's a good guy. Maybe he's the Messiah. Maybe he's somewhere in between there. But you're still trying to figure out what to do with Jesus, like what you need to get straight in your life, what you need to get in order, whether it's your sexuality or it's what to do with your money or it's where you're going to live. But you're trying to kind of get your life in order and figure out what Jesus requires for you to come to him. But here's the only thing that Jesus requires for you to come to him. Thirst. That thirst is the humble admission that you can't do it on your own. It's a humble admission that you cannot live on your own, that you cannot produce righteousness on your own, that you can't make it on your own. Apart from him, you can do nothing. That's the thirst, and that's the only thing that's required to come to Jesus. And so if conversion to Christ, to Christianity, is just admitting that you are thirsty and that you are dying and then going to Jesus for a drink, if that's conversion, then hear me, Christian discipleship is learning that all of life must ultimately lead back again and again and again to drink of Jesus. The beginning is waking up to realize that you're dying of thirst and you need Jesus, but then the continuing work is waking up every single day to the awareness that you're still desperately in need of him. And that without him, you're going to die. This is the Jesus who divides the room. Because if you go and read the rest of this passage, the crowd of the Jewish leaders are still divided. They're all over the place. They still want to figure him out. They still want to hold on to their own authority. And how many of us just labor under the idea that we have to put all these things together before we can come to Jesus, that we've got to get it all put together, that we got to get our finances in order, and we have to have a great marriage, and we have to raise great kids, and you have to know exactly what you're doing in your career, and your whole life gets put in order, and then Jesus takes you and shines you up and sanctifies you, and it's off to heaven. But church, let me say this. You will never be thirsty if you try to put that face on. The heart of Christianity, first and foremost, is a longing and a thirst. It's this unquenchable longing that can only be satisfied with Christ himself. And so Jesus says to us the most beautiful words that have ever been said. Come to me and drink. All who are thirsty, come to me. Drink. So to end us this morning, I have a question. How does this stream of water come to us in Jesus? How does this work? Well, hear me here. Back to the Old Testament. As God is giving instructions to Moses in Exodus 17 about how the water is supposed to come out of the rock for the people of Israel, the text says that he was to strike the rock with his staff. But Moses, at that point, we're told, is so frustrated with the people of God because they're grumbling about him that he strikes the rock in anger. And he'll do this again where he'll actually strike it twice and will be judged for that. But Moses, in anger, in frustration, takes his staff, strikes the rock, and out of the rock pours the water for God's people. And that's a really important idea. The rock was struck in anger, and wrath fell on the rock. Because of that, waters flowed to all the people. Church, we're going to see in a few weeks that Jesus was struck by the staff of God. And we're going to see that in the cross, Jesus bears the wrath of God on himself. He was broken so that out of him might flow living waters to you and to me. So are you thirsty? Now, Father, I'm so grateful for this text this week in my life. Because, God, I can, if I'm not really careful, I can play in the world of my head. I can play in the world where I'm trying to figure you out and trying to systematize how you work and trying to parse it all out so that I've got it into nice, manageable packages. And then I just kind of follow through with those motions. But God, what you've convicted me, and I hope you're convicting my brothers and sisters here today about, is that if there's no real, genuine thirst for Jesus in our hearts, then we might miss you. And God, I remember back to when I was first converted, how thirsty I was. God, I pray that you would just stir that up in my heart again. That you would stir up in our hearts a desire for Jesus and nothing else, that nothing else will satisfy, that no matter how much we think, how much we read, how much we learn, and all of those things being so important and yet second to how much we come to you and drink. Father, some in this room probably need to come to you for the first time. Maybe they've been playing this game of their head. They've been arguing in themselves about who you are and what you're like and where you're from and whether you're worthy to be followed. But you say, I have the full authority. I am from God. And I would pray, Father, that those people would recognize the thirst deep in their soul and they would run to you today, falling on their knees before you, admitting that they are thirsty and that you are the only one who can quench that. But Father, for many in this room, we are just guilty of not returning to the well. And so God, I would pray for myself, for many in this room, that today we would return to you. That we would run to you for more of you. all thirsty, come to me and drink. Lord, let that be our cry this morning. We are thirsty. Fill us. We pray this in the name of Jesus.